Hello and welcome to this week's Oxcast Extra. I'm here with Professor Simon Palfrey, who has been curating the Shakespeare's Dead exhibition at the Bodleian Library. Hello, Simon.
Hello.
So this year marks the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. What made you decide to examine his dead in this exhibition?
The idea was that we wanted to play on the idea that Shakespeare is actually dead and gone, but with a play on words that we're looking at the dead in Shakespeare. We thought there was a good way of focusing upon, paradoxically enough, the life in Shakespeare. So it's the idea of the life in death in Shakespeare, partly because many of his plays lead up to moments of dying and death, and it's the climax of the plays. And partly because there's something about death on stage which epitomises a lot of what makes Shakespeare last, which is the generation of possibilities out of death. So we thought it was a good way of focusing upon the ongoing life of Shakespeare.
And what particular themes do you draw out in this exhibition?
We've got lots of different themes. So among them, one of the cases is the places of death. So, for example, we look at the particular environments of death in Shakespeare. So that doesn't just mean the places in which death happens, but the way in which a place might itself evoke or express or even be death. So, for example, you have the tomb in Romeo and Juliet, to which all the action is headed, and it seems to be that particular place seems to epitomise all of the desire, all of the sort of destructive, self-immolating desire of Romeo and Juliet, kind of focuses on the tomb. Or in Macbeth, in the first scene, they talk about the battle as memorising another Golgotha. Now, Golgotha's the place of crucifixion, but also it's the place of dead men's skulls. And it's as though the play itself is, it seems to evoke, landscape's the wrong word for this, it's kind of a deathscape in which the action happens in a place of dead men's skulls. You're building upon, you're acting upon death upon death upon death. In the same speech, he says, "My gashes cry for help," and the idea that the wounds themselves are sort of crying or speaking. Or you have sort of the blasted heath of Macbeth, or the imaginary cliff in King Lear. And so the idea that the place itself seems to share in this death. And very often Shakespeare's places aren't, you know, named. Even when he sets things in, supposedly in a city like in Timon of Athens, the most important action happens in a wilderness outside Athens, which again is a sort of liminal place in between life and death.
Like purgatory.
A bit like a purgatory, but a place of a kind of... I mean, that's an interesting question, because, I mean, purgatory was something which had been officially abolished by the Protestant religion and the Anglican Church, and so purgatory was a fiction that had been invented by the Antichrist of the Pope. But that left a big problem. The purpose of purgatory is not simply to sort of purge your sins, but it's also a place in which your loved ones can be suffering for a particular amount of time, and you can pray for them. You can remit, you can lessen their time in purgatory by doing good deeds, or by praying, or by giving money, or by buying, you know, icons or whatever, and retain a connection between the living and the dead, and you get rid of that. And this contributes to one of the most significant differences of this early modern period, which is a isolation, a sort of spiritual desolation often, which is the other side of a much more individuated relationship to God, is with that comes enormous personal responsibility. And I think Shakespeare is very interested in this. I mean, what happens when kind of the places like purgatory or the mediating power of ritual disappears and you're left alone? One of the themes is that, and also to do with place of death, is also the stage itself. One of his favourite metaphors is the idea of life is like a, you know, to be alive is to be a player on the stage, you know, a poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more, and this sort of thing. And the idea that the players were sometimes called shadows, and that sort of evokes this idea of a figure who's not quite real, who's performing somebody else's words, is here and then gone, is on the bare boards before thousands of people, and this figure can't quite reach them. And so again, it has this sense of existential, experiential isolation. And very, very often when Shakespeare evokes acting, it has this edge of melancholy or fatalism. Richard II or Juliet, these sort of characters talk about it, and, you know, this idea of arriving so as to pass away, and so this idea of... So that's another of them. Quite a lot of the cases are about the distinctiveness of death on stage.
Yes.
How death on stage is different from death in as a so-called real life. One of the things, so for example, you have ghosts, but most of those ghosts aren't, as it were, suffering in purgatory. The only one who is Hamlet's, old Hamlet's ghost. Most of them express the anguish or the guilt of the living. And so again, it's this idea that the death or the dead are often, in Shakespeare, an expression of life, an expression of undying passion. Even the ghost in Hamlet is stung by, you know, remorse and anger and desire for revenge and unsleeping desire. That's what keeps him up. That's what keeps him up at night.
Yeah.
Then you've got the, you know, figures like in the romances like Pericles and Winter's Tale, where particularly women seem to return from the dead. Whether they were actually dead or not is often unclear. There's in this sort of space in between life and death, and they return, and their return from death. The way we see it is that it's not, as it were, a spiritual resurrection, so much as an expression again of the desires of the living. And so it's a fulfilment of the longing, of the grief of the living for the dead.
Yeah.
And so it satisfies that. We look at the ways of dying.
Yes.
Which is an important one.
They're quite varied and gruesome, some of them.
Some of them, yeah. I mean, you've got the famous ones, like in Titus Andronicus, where the two, you know, evil brothers are baked on a pie.
Yes.
You've got various sort of spectacular deaths, like Cleopatra with the asp and so forth. We sort of juxtapose a bill of mortality from the City of London. Would produce a bill of mortality each week, which listed the ways people died. And it was things like, gout and teeth. A lot of people died from teeth. You know, wind. And the biggest one of all was plague. And sometimes, you have 20, the next week was 100, the next week was 2,000, the next week was 8,000. This sort of terrible thing. And the occasional murder. Now, of course, the deaths in Shakespeare are very, very different. Where there's a sort of a death from natural causes, it tends to happen offstage because it's not very dramatic.
But things like suicide, Macbeth's wife, doesn't she kill herself?
Offstage. That's offstage, yeah. But she kills herself offstage. And in fact, almost all the deaths in Macbeth happen offstage, including Duncan's and Macbeth's himself. They're all killed offstage in Macbeth. It's one of the curious things about that play.
Mm.
But there are plenty of suicides on stage in Shakespeare. And so I think the big difference there that we look at is the way in which, in real life, death tends to happen from within, and it slowly, insidiously takes away life. Whereas in play world, death happens from outside. It comes from outside, and it can be, as it were, seen as it's arriving.
Yeah.
So it's externalized. It's given an expressive body. The single death that we spend the most time with in the exhibition is Desdemona's in Othello, which is a unique death for its horrible, excruciating duration. It goes on for a long time. It's also unique in the way you get intimate entrance into the emotions of Desdemona as she's suffering this assault from her husband, as she's struggling for life, as she's trying to resist him.
Mm.
She's trying to make him listen, and he won't. So you're with that. But also at the same time, you get entrance into Othello's struggle. His struggle to, you know, rationalise a deed to himself. And then his struggle actually to kill her. It takes a long time because he doesn't want to stain their wedding sheets with her blood. So he smothers her or stifles her, depending on which text you read. And it's difficult.
Yeah.
And then you think she's dead and she's hidden behind the curtain when her friend Amelia comes in. And then you hear her voice from behind the curtain. So has she come back from the dead? Wasn't she dead at all? Is it a ghost talking? It's a very, again, this very strange space that Shakespeare seems fascinated by, which is this space between living and dying and dead. We're also interested in the scripting of death, the acting of death. One of the, of course, main reasons why death on stage is so different from death off stage is that it's not just one party who's at issue. You've got a character and you've got an actor, and they're not they are the same. They're in the same body, but they're not the same. And so the character dies, but the actor does not. And sometimes I think Shakespeare plays at that division and pushes at it. And so an example is these heroines in the tragedies, and most obviously not just tragedies, tragic comedies. And there's Desdemona, who, after she's finally, as it were, silenced, and she sort of dies seemingly spontaneously. It's very, very curious. She's then left on stage, the actor, for another 300 lines while the action goes on around her. And not only does the action go on, but everyone's sort of talking intermittently about her.
Mm.
and falling upon her, pointing at her, touching her, kissing her, holding her, weeping over her, until finally, in almost the last speech, the curtain around the bed is drawn again and the tragic loading is hidden. So it's an extraordinary... I think it's a sort of suffering that the actor has to endure to act dead all that time. And then in one of Shakespeare's next tragedies, King Lear, he does exactly the same thing with Cordelia.
Yes.
When Lear brings Cordelia's body in. And once again, the whole focus is she living or not?
Mm.
And Lear, somehow, whether it's an imaginary mirror or glass or not, he brings the glass to her mouth and said, we'll see from this whether she breathes or not. You know,
yeah.
It's a miracle. And he ends saying, look there, look there. And so the gaze of everyone on stage and everyone off stage has to be at least partly upon this body of the actor.
Mm.
So what does it mean if his or her chest is rising up and down? What does it mean? So I think that's interesting. We have another case which is about the famous last words, which looks at the particular way Shakespeare scripts death for his actors and the technique of cueing that he developed.
Can you explain what you mean by cueing?
I mean in Shakespeare's period, the actors didn't work off the full script. Like today, they have a little book of Hamlet, say, and they will find where, you know, if you're playing Hamlet, you look for the parts where Hamlet is and you'll remember that and sort of ignore the rest.
Oh.
In those days, there was only one copy of the play, and the parts were distributed on what were called rolls. This is where we get the word rolls from. So you get a long sheet of paper which had the cue of two or three words, which would indicate it's time for you to speak, and then your speech, and then your next cue, and then your next speech, and then your next cue, and then your next speech, right?
Yeah.
And nothing else. That's all it had. And that's what the actor learned from. So they learned their cue and their speech, and when the cue came, they'd speak their words.
Gosh.
Now, what Shakespeare does with dying scenes is that he develops this technique of repeated cues. In other words, the cue is said more than once.
Yes.
And what that means is that the actor speaking the final words knows that the words that are cued by his final words can be spoken while he still has more to say.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so an example is with Hamlet, where in the folio text, there's a few texts, three texts of Hamlet, but in one of them, his last words are, "The rest is silence."
Yes.
Famously. But actually, in the folio, the big kind of book, it's "The rest is silence, oh, 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 oh." And so his final words are these four O's. And so it begs the question, what is the cue given to the Horatio actor who comes in with... good night, sweet prince, and angels, blah, blah, sing me till I rest. Well, if the Horatio cue is the rest is silence, then Hamlet is going to be speaking over him. If the Horatio cue is O or O-O, then he will hear O-O, and Hamlet, the Hamlet actor, will still have O-O to say. And what this does is various things. And what that does there is it means that the Hamlet actor, who was Burbage, you know, the number one actor of the period, played all of the main roles, the hero roles, will know that he has his dying to himself, as it were. He can die in his own space and his own time. And you don't have that awful kind of static, stagey thing where someone is dying and everyone stops and waits.
Yeah.
And then when they finally stop moving and groaning, you carry on with the play. You die in your own... And so it allows there to be this kind of contrapuntal sort of... harmony between the different players, where the Hamlet actor can be in his pain, suffering, slowly dying, while Horatio is saying his final words.
Yeah.
You get the same thing with King Lear, with look there, he says, and there are two versions of Lear, and one of them it's oh, 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 oh again, and the other one it's look there, look there. There are a lot of examples of it. Richard III's My Kingdom for a Horse, which is said twice. Shakespeare's always, he's unusual in the choices he gives to actors, and in the responsibility he gives to actors, but also the challenges he gives to actors, more than any other playwright. And his death scenes are a perfect example of this. And it makes the scenes more natural, more lifelike.
Yeah.
But also it allows the actor to take his character into a sort of space, a sort of existential, almost a metaphysical space all their own, when they're not quite in the same world as everybody else. It sort of sections the stage.
Wow. I feel like I've learnt so much about these final death scenes already. What got you into Shakespeare in the first place?
Oh, Well, I think what got me into Shakespeare in the first place was just the sense of possibility in Shakespeare, really, if to sum it up in one thing. Not only that there was so much to say and so much to think, but the works themselves and the words and the scenes seemed just absolutely pregnant with life. And also, you know, you read a bit of, you know, as a sort of fundamentally ignorant undergraduate or something, when you're just beginning to read it, and you read criticism, I certainly didn't, and thought it was all done from a kind of position of superiority and distance from the actual moment. I felt this very strongly, and reading The Tempest, and I came upon a scene which at that stage I'd never seen anyone talk about, which was a scene when the drunkards, Trinculo and Stefano and Caliban, they've got drunk on these kind of they kind of float in from the shipwreck. Stefano and Trinculo do on a bottle of wine, they drink their wine, they get drunk, and they sort of want to have, and Caliban wants them to go and kill Prospero as a rebellion. Yeah. Anyway, and then instead of doing that, they get drunk, and Trinculo, this kind of hopeless jester, says, they say this, but something, this is quite something like this anyway, he says this, they say there's but five upon the isle, if the other three be brained like us, the state totters, he said. And so I love those. I love the idea of brained like us, because you know, the idea of some people have minds like us, brains like us, but also they're drunk. But also brain suggests the violence, and to be brained is to have your head smashed in, which of course is what Caliban wants them to do to Prospero. And then the idea of the state totters, it's such an extraordinary statement about rebellion or subversion. So I love this idea of incendiary energy, which no one ever mentions, because they just say, oh, it's a play all about reconciliation and courtliness. It's just much more than that. So I like that. And then you can go to tiny bits. Just the language has got so much going on. It was formal linguistic and scenic possibilities which seemed to generate existential and experiential possibilities for not just for the characters but for me.
Yeah. Brilliant. What's your favourite death in Shakespeare?
My favourite death?
Yeah.
I like the death of Duncan in Macbeth, because I think it's necessary.
Yeah. What did you think of how they portrayed it, Michael Fassbender portrayed it in...
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it? No. Okay.
I've been meaning to look at it. I've been meaning to watch it. With my kids, I think it might be good for them.
How old are they?
They're old. But I like Mercutio's death in Romeo and Juliet, which is another example when he says a plague in your houses, which is another one of these things. And I like the kind of the lingering curse that he gives to the world. It's quite nice.
Yeah. What's it been like creating this exhibition? What's the process been like?
It's been eye-opening, been very interesting. It's something that we entered with a little bit of reluctance at the start, just because we thought, oh, God, yet another thing celebrating Shakespeare. You know, put it in, let's just leave it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's generated momentum, and it's something that's been rewarding in all sorts of ways, partly because of the public engagement. Mm. You know, it's much more... That kind of gap between the academy, the university, and the public is disappearing much more, and that's quite nice. And it's really nice to communicate. There's always a frustration as a scholarly thing. Well, I'm writing this for, you know, there's no reason why lots of people can't read this, but they just don't know about it.
Yeah.
And so that's a frustration. And so that's been really good. Initially, the idea was to have, as I said, the life in Shakespeare was actually the impetus. That's what we want to bring out, the life. Not the life in Shakespeare's life. I don't care about Shakespeare's life. Not really. I couldn't care less. But I care about the plays and the poems, the life in them. So we wanted to reveal that. And we initially wanted an exhibition which was very interactive and dynamic and brought out something of the theatre, because most museum or library exhibitions are very static, quiet, based around objects. But that's very, very hard. When you're in a library, there's a limit to what you can do. So there's a bit of that going on. There's quite a lot of activities going on with Oxford 2016 thing. We've got the sonnet and soliloquy booth, and the Creation Theatre are doing, and various performances, and there's the Tim Crouch coming in with his play. There's quite a lot going on. We've tried to do as much as we can. We've got a nice little app going with in the exhibition, where people can find seven of the different objects and ask different questions. But the main thing we've tried to do is make the captions lively, rather than having the captions simply this book is a 16th century manuscript which was received by the library. Some of the display things are, you know, texts, unique texts that the Bodleian has of Venus and Adonis or Hamlet or something, and, you know, we show them and that's fantastic. But a lot of the things we're showing aren't, as it were, Shakespeare texts. What they are, they're books or images which evoke something of death in Shakespeare. But in every case, Shakespeare's plays don't simply mirror that or transcribe it, represent that. They trobe upon it. They kind of riff upon it. They transform it. Shakespeare takes his stuff elsewhere. He's not a kind of documentary writer who's, you know, just mirroring everyday life. He's transformative. We want to make the captions bring something of that out. And so what we do is you get the object, sort of generates a quotation from Shakespeare, which then generates a caption. And so you've got this process of trying to bring out something of this creative, transformative life.
Mm.
That's what we try to do.
Fantastic. It sounds so exciting.
Oh, you never know.
So tell me in a bit more detail about what events are happening on Saturday.
So, okay, so yeah, Shakespeare's, well, they pretend that he was born and died on the same day.
Was he not?
It's very convenient. Who knows? Maybe. Anyway, so on Saturday at the Western Library, you know, which is, you know, this amazing position, which is great because the Western Library itself is really important because it really does open up the library and the university to the public in a way that hasn't been possible before. It's a shared space. It's really great. So we're doing various things. There's the exhibition itself will be open.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy the book.
Wonderful.
Shakespeare's Dead, which has just been published. With Croatian Theatre, we're doing this thing where we're having this booth where we've identified a bunch of sonnets and soliloquies from the plays with various themes, you know, desolation or perversity or longing or sadness. And it's a booth where you can express one of these yourself and pitch yourself up against some very well-known actors who've done the same thing. And then more library specific, we've got having a quill, a sort of a Renaissance quill of the kind that Shakespeare himself may have used, and you can learn how to use that and write like Shakespeare. And a printing press, similarly using a printing press from the period as well, so getting closer to the period, removing some of that sort of mystique, or perhaps not. Perhaps feeling something of the mystique of the early modern technology.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
No problem.